Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After a nine-day strike, West Virginia teachers have reached a deal with Governor Jim Justice. Teachers and all state employees will receive a 5% raise. We did a show about public education budget cuts 2 weeks ago and spoke with a teacher in West Virginia who said that teacher pay there is so low that teachers often take second or third jobs. They are also very concerned about high health care costs. In some cases, they're paying $1,000 a month. The strike was entering its ninth day, making it the longest in West Virginia's history. Legislators finally came up with an agreement that satisfied school workers' demands, also all state employee demands. In just a couple minutes, we will be joined by Joe White, executive director of the West Virginia School Service Personnel Association. That is one of the unions whose members were on strike over low pay and high health care costs. According to the New York Times, teachers in West Virginia earn an average of $46,000, which is $13,000 less than the national average. In only three states, teachers earn less: Mississippi, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. And Oklahoma teachers are now talking about going on strike. A couple of weeks ago, we also spoke with a teacher in Oklahoma, and things are so bad in Oklahoma, this is so hard to believe, but schools there are actually closed on Mondays. So kids are only going to school 4 days a week because of drastic budget cuts. And joining us now is Joe White, executive director of the West Virginia School Service Personnel Association. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. We spoke with one of your colleagues a couple of weeks ago about the challenges teachers are facing in West Virginia. You just struck a deal. Give us the latest.
Well, the deal was it was a 5% increase in salaries across the board. That's for teachers, service personnel, state police, and all state employees. 5% across the board, and a task force for the PEIA, which is the health insurance.
And Joe, can you give us a sense of teacher pay in Virginia? When we spoke to one of your colleagues a couple weeks ago, she said starting pay is around $32,000, $34,000 a year. What is average pay for a teacher who's been teaching, say, for 10 or 20 years?
Well, I will tell you this. The teacher salaries that I'm not day-to-day operations with, I'm with the service personnel. And I will tell you that the average service personnel salary in the state of West Virginia is $25,000 a year.
Wow. And service personnel, can you be more specific?
Service personnel are your bus drivers, secretaries, cooks, custodians, maintenance, aides, secretaries.
Mm. You know, Joe, a lot of people would assume that the cost of living in West Virginia is very low. The housing costs, I'm sure, are far lower than they are in the Bay Area. But what about everything else? Everyday needs, restaurants, just overall necessities?
You know, as far as the travel that I've done, we're probably about the same as a lot of the states. But in your bigger cities, I'm sure the cost of living's a lot higher. But different parts of West Virginia you live in, the cost of living does increase quite a bit. You get in your city areas, it's higher. You get out in the countries, where I live, out of town, it's a little bit lower. But the cost of living is fairly equitable with the surrounding states.
Can you talk about how you all came up with the 5% number?
The 5% number is a number that they came up with in trying to get the starting out package for teachers. As I said, I don't do a lot of my research on the teachers, just the service personnel, but the starting salaries were so low, and they was 49th in the nation with salaries. So they had to come up with something that could get a start to where they can be equitable with the rest of the nation in salaries.
Well, what are you hearing from service workers, Jim, about this strike? This is one of the longest strikes in West Virginia's history. Joe.
It is. That's okay. It is one of the longest strikes in history. Actually, this is only the second strike in education, and I think they quoted 147 years. What we did here, now you got to take into consideration, this is the first time that it was 55 county strong and wide. Service personnel, this is the first time that the service personnel has been on strike in the history of our association.
Wow. So what did you hear from service workers just about the power of the strike, the solidarity in West Virginia and outside of West Virginia?
Oh, the overall feeling, if you could just be here and see the capacity crowds. They've shut the Capitol doors down because people couldn't go in. There would be 1,000 standing outside waiting to get on. And it was just overpowering. And the folks traveled, you know, some of the places that they traveled daily was 4 hours away to come in and be a part of this. And it was just overwhelming. And what really surprised me and really stuck with me is how it was across the board that everybody was involved in this. Everybody was.
Hmm. Joe, what are your thoughts about what's happening really across the country? Because it's not just West Virginia. We had a teacher on from Oklahoma about 2 weeks ago who talked about the drastic budget cuts there. They are now teaching only 4 days a week. Some of these teachers have jobs at Walmart. I mean, even here in very wealthy California, teachers have to buy their own school supplies. You know, they do crowdfunding. One of my friends did crowdfunding for a rug in her class because it was so cold. I mean, so it's not just West Virginia. It's really across the country.
It is across the country. And, you know, what we feel here, we think that the education should be the centerpiece. We have to invest. States has to invest in education to bring our country forward. Now, I'm a very strong advocate that I think the United States, our country, is top-notch to any. I am proud to live in the United States, in West Virginia. This is our home. But what they have to do, they have to make education a centerpiece to move things forward. And a lot of folks are not doing that. They've gotten away from that. But it's very clear that West Virginia, the people, has spoken in West Virginia. We understand that they're speaking across the nation. And they have to understand and put we the people, for the people, and of the people back in. The people done this movement in West Virginia, and I think it's going to come across the nation.
We're speaking with Joe White, Executive Director of the West Virginia School Service Personnel Association. Just a couple hours ago, we learned that the teachers reached a deal with Governor Jim Justice. Teachers and all state employees will receive a 5% raise. We're going to let you go in just a few minutes, Joe, but I wanted to also ask you, what has this really taught you about the power of striking?
It teaches me a lot. Of course, my daddy, who's dead and gone now, he was a UMWA member. He was a coal miner, and I can remember the picket lines when I was a child. It's just it teaches me that the labor movement, and a lot of people has gotten away from the labor movement in the last several years, but it is powerful. Mm-hmm. You get the voice of the people together, it makes a big difference.
What's next for teachers in West Virginia, Joe?
I don't know. As far as I know, on our end, the group that we represent, we'll have a conference call later on today and explain this deal to them. It has passed the House. It's passed the Senate. It now goes to the governor's desk. But they want to see it in writing. The trust factor has been broken here in West Virginia, and they actually want to see the governor sign this bill before any decisions made.
Where is the money coming from, Joe? Some people on social media say it's coming out of a budget for social services for low-income people, and West Virginia is dealing with a massive opioid crisis right now, and people
are
a healthcare crisis. People are really in need of help. So where is this money coming from?
Well, you know, the governor put new revenue projections out of $58 million. Some of the leadership didn't want to accept that. I trust it's there. I trust the gentleman that's working on his behalf who has been in finance for many, many years. I believe it's there. Now, they want to spin it. They want to spin it in a different way, and they say that they're going to take it from other programs. Listen, I think the money's there. This is a $4.9 billion budget. They didn't have to cut anything. They can say what they want to say. We know that the money's there, so it is what it is there.
And what about your health care costs? How will this affect that?
The health care costs, we have the part of the deal was the PEIA, which was our Public Employees Insurance Agency, and it continued to have increased costs, out-of-pockets, co-pays. They was doing a family tier where people's premiums would have doubled and some tripled. That has been frozen for 17 months. A task force has been formed and to come up with a funding source for that. so this has a big impact on the health care for the public employees in this state.
Well, Joe, congratulations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. We made history today. Thank you very much.
Joe White is Executive Director of the West Virginia School Service Personnel Association. He represents workers like school bus drivers who make about $25,000 a year in West Virginia. And we just got word that teachers have reached a deal to receive a 5% raise, but it's not just teachers. It's all state employees in West Virginia. We're also getting word that Oklahoma teachers might be going on strike. A couple weeks ago, we did a show and learned about what's happening across the country. In Oklahoma, the school week is now down to just 4 days a week. Kids are not going to school on Mondays because of budget cuts there. So we will definitely continue to follow this issue. And thank you to Joe White for joining us. We're going to take a quick musical break. And after the break, we'll be joined by graphic artist Bonnie Siegler, who's out with a new book called Signs of Resistance. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Last week, protesters blocked off the streets surrounding San Francisco's office of the Customs and Immigration Service, ICE, to protest immigration enforcement raids. On the streets in front of the building, local artist David Solnit and other activists spelled the words "Keep Families Together" in huge, colorful block letters. Images and posters are a key part of protests, from homemade signs at women's marches to painted fabric banners carried by Native American water protectors protesting the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Art has been such an important part of some of the most important social movements of our time. In her new book, Signs of Resistance, today's guest, Bonnie Siegler, has compiled visual expressions of resistance throughout history. Bonnie Siegler is a graphic designer and author of the new book. Her studio, 8 and a half, works in branding, web, and editorial design. And Bonnie joins us in studio. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming in. So, like so many people, you were shocked and depressed and angry after the election, and you were asked to put together a presentation at a conference in Las Vegas, and the only thing on your mind was
the resistance and design for the resistance. That's so I suggested that I talk about that, and luckily they agreed. So I spent the summer gathering images, most of which I knew just from my graphic design history. But I started organizing it and finding amazing things and amazing stories. And then when the talk was very successful, and people asked me, "Would you send me your presentation? I want to show other people." So I told my publisher, and they said, maybe that's a book. Mm-hmm. So then I made the book.
I mean, the visuals in this book are amazing, from photos to posters. It's really incredible. How did you begin this journey? I mean, some of the old ones you found, like, how did you find these amazing images?
The National Archives and the Library of Congress are amazing, and we have access to those images as citizens still. Maybe they'll take that away. I don't know. I am a student of graphic design history. So there was a lot that I knew, and then I just built around it and looked for specific messaging.
When you started doing the research, what really struck you the most about the messaging, the design, the colors?
The early stuff, which I wasn't as familiar with, blew my mind. Suffrage also. Mm-hmm. All the anti-immigration stuff that started in 1850, I was shocked by that.
Yeah, let's talk more about that, because we've done a lot of shows about that.
A group called the Know Nothing Party brought itself together. They actually called themselves the Know Nothing Party because when someone you would think it means they know nothing. But in fact, when someone said, "Are you a member of that party?" they would say, I know nothing, because they didn't want to be out about their feelings. So in 1850, they decided no other people should be allowed to come to this country. And they had this idea that you had to be in the country for 21 years before you could become a citizen. And that's on their flag, 21 years. And they call themselves Native Americans.
That to me, I was really floored by this, because when I first saw it, it's a flag and it says, Native Americans, beware of foreign influence. And I thought, huh, I've never heard of this in Native American history.
And the Trail of Tears had just ended. I mean, recently. It was in recent history, and they still...
Well, in 1853, this is when massive genocide was taking place here in California. I mean, that was right in the middle of it. The Know-Nothing Party, Know-Nothing, do you know what happened to this party?
I mean, in the 1880s, I believe, the Chinese Immigration Act passed. So parts of what they were promoting started working its way into the mainstream.
You've got another one, C.J. Taylor, 1889. The Irish are targeted unfairly. In this melting pot, the different ethnicities are mixing well together, all except for the Irish. And it's basically a big pot with a bunch of people in it. And someone wearing a flag with a spoon that says equal rights is kind of stirring the pot.
It's crazy. At some point, every ethnic group was targeted. That's what's amazing.
When you were compiling this and seeing these images from the 1800s and then looking at what we're dealing with today, how did it really shape your views about where we are right now? I mean, I was just reading yesterday in the Chronicle about, I mean, they had crackdowns near where farm workers are, 7-Eleven in the Bay Area, massive crackdowns in the last couple weeks. We're going to do a show on Thursday about immigration detention centers. But what was that like doing
that? It just broke my heart. I mean, that we haven't moved forward. This is a replay of the 1800s. It really is. It's so cruel and indifferent, and you would have thought we'd come further.
How much effect did these images have back then?
They were very powerful. The anti-immigrant posters were very powerful. This is actually one of the only movements where the right, I'm just going to use that loosely, was effective through art. For the rest of history, it's really been the left. Most artists have been on the left, poets, musicians, etc. So, but during immigration, anti-immigration, the fear and racism and xenophobia was just baked in. And
you also write about the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was passed in 1882, and you have this. Is this a newspaper?
It's a broadsheet.
A broadsheet. Hip hurrah, Chinese excluded. The Democratic Chinese Exclusion Bill has been signed by our Democratic president. Hip hurrah, the white man is on top. Let every Democrat and all other good citizens turn out and ratify this Democratic measure.
Republicans and Democrats flipped sides.
Right. And then you also have, there's a photo, a racist photo of a Chinese man. What else struck you about what you found about immigration?
Well, that one that you have, the literacy test, nope, on the next page, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like that was actually pro-immigration, and it was showing the absurdity of a literacy test and of building a wall, and that was in 1916.
Wow. Even back then, people understood the absurdity and unjustness of issuing a literacy test for immigrants. This cartoon appeared in Puck, the first successful humor magazine of its day, and was drawn to protest the Immigration Act, which passed in 1917 anyway. The act required all immigrants to be able to read 30 to 40 words.
Ridiculous.
We're speaking today with Bonnie Siegler about her new book, Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. After the election, she put together a presentation at a conference in Las Vegas, and so many of the attendees were asking for these images, and so she decided to put them together in a book. And Bonnie will be speaking tonight at Green Apple Books on the Park, 1231 9th Avenue in the Inner Sunset at 7:30. It's a Q&A with Roman Mars, host of 99. 99% invisible. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. I know that so many of you have been involved in the movements that Bonnie includes in her book. Civil rights, the anti-war Vietnam movement, women's equality, AIDS, the Bush oil wars, Black Lives Matter, and then where we are today. If you're an artist or if you've been affected by images and art, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about just resistance art and protest art throughout history? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. It's interesting that you say the right was really successful in the 1800s and the early 1900s on issues of immigration. What happened after that?
Well, then, I mean, again, the right in quotes, but then they were in power. I mean, they were keeping women from getting the vote. They were starting a war on the other side of the world that we didn't need to be in. So they were in power. There was no protest or resistance necessary. So the left had to rise up and make their voices heard.
And at what point, I mean, the images of the suffragettes is incredible, but at what point during your research did you see artists on the left start to rise up?
It was really the Vietnam War that it was. I mean, the world of graphic design in particular and poster design was in full swing, and I think people realized they could use their skills to express their rage.
As a graphic artist, I mean, what are your thoughts about the... Because you've got artists and then you have citizens who are creating art, and both images take off.
Absolutely.
Right? It depends what really sticks.
No, I think the work done by non-artists, non-professionals is just as powerful. Really, it's about the passion, the emotion, and the ability to communicate. And when somebody does a poster for the Women's March in Washington, where I have a lot of posters that were done by just angry people, they're almost more powerful for their crudeness, for their intensity.
Before we get into Vietnam, let's talk a little bit about the civil rights movement, because one of the images that I was most affected by was this flag that hung outside of the NAACP's office in 1936. And you write, throughout the 1930s, the NAACP would unfurl a flag outside its Fifth Avenue headquarters in New York every time they received news of a lynching. They had only a moment to capture the attention of drivers or walkers, so the design needed to be as big, bold, and simple as possible. And this flag said, "A man was lynched yesterday." And it's right above a U.S. flag. This one, really, I was so affected by this one.
Apparently, people in the North just didn't really understand what was going on. And they felt they needed the attention of the country to make it stop. So that was the solution they came up with. And that ad, The Shame of America, which ran in...
1922. The Shame of America, this was an ad. It says, "Do you know that the United States is the only land on earth where human beings are burned at the stake? In 4 years, 1918 to 1921, 28 people were publicly burned by American mobs. 3,436 people lynched, 1889 to 1922.
And they were right. I didn't know that. I had no idea, even though I have studied some history.
I mean... There's a lynching museum is being built right now in Alabama by Bryan Stevenson,
yes.
Which is going to be amazing.
I've seen the model for it. Incredible.
You've seen the model for it?
There are slabs that hang down from the ceiling but don't touch the floor.
Wow.
With names of people who were lynched. I get chills just thinking about it.
When you did this research, how many images are in here?
240.
Okay, that's a lot. 240. So what was going through my mind is, when Bonnie found this flag, "A man was lynched yesterday," did you have the time to then research to find out how the public responded to this?
Not so much. I did as much as I did enough research so that I could write a deep caption about it. But with 240 images, I couldn't go further than that. Mm-hmm. I wish I could. I would love to.
I mean, in some ways you don't need to, but it would be interesting for this specific one to find out.
Absolutely.
Because this was on the streets of Fifth Avenue.
I know.
I mean, under the flag, there are cars, people walking by. It's not that high above the street, so chances are you probably would see it if you walked by. What else struck you about the images you found during the civil rights movement?
Well, that I actually don't show the actual image that relates to the story of Emmett Till because it's too horrific. Mm. But the mother, his mother's decision to publish a photo of what he looked like before they buried him was really one of the big sparks of the civil rights movement because it was proof. You couldn't turn away. You couldn't understand how this horrific thing could happen. And it was published around the world.
And just to give listeners information on this one, in Bonnie Siegler's book, Signs of Resistance, she writes, 1955, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy from Chicago visiting cousins in Mississippi. While there, he was brutally beaten, shot in the head, and dumped in a river, murdered for allegedly flirting with and whistling at a white woman. Emmett Till's mother defied norms and insisted that the coffin be open at his funeral to show the world the brutal horror of racial violence. This photo of his disfigured face, not pictured, was seen around the world. The amazing thing about this is this coffin is now at the African American Museum in Washington, D.C.
I didn't know that.
Talk about the connection between Emmett Till, his mom's decision, and Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks said that when she was sitting on the bus, she knew she couldn't, she just pictured Emmett Till and knew she couldn't move. She had to support that movement. You know, she had to do something in response to his sacrifice. And a few years ago, a book was written. The woman who had said Emmett Till had flirted with her admitted just a few years ago that she had been lying.
Mm-hmm. Today we're speaking with graphic designer Bonnie Siegler about her new book, Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. Bonnie will be speaking tonight with Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible, at Green Apple Books on the Park. It's in the Inner Sunset, 1231 9th Avenue, and it starts at 7:30. This is your call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by filmmaker Stanley Nelson. We'll talk about his new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising. It examines the impact historically black colleges and universities have had on American history, culture, and identity. Stanley Nelson's parents were the product of historically black colleges and universities. There was no other place his parents could go to school, but they refused to be denied a higher education. So we'll talk about how these universities were and are advancing justice in the U.S. And then on Thursday, we will talk about immigrant detention centers and all of the crackdowns that have happened over the past couple of weeks. Today, we are joined by graphic designer Bonnie Siegler. After the election, she was asked to give a presentation at a conference. The only thing on her mind was resistance. So she put a presentation together about resistance art, and so many people wanted the images. So she decided to turn it into a beautiful book. It's called Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. And I wish we had a couple hours because she focuses on immigrant suffrage, American icons, civil rights, Vietnam, AIDS, the Bush oil wars. Just there's so much in this book. And she'll be speaking tonight with Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible, at Green Apple Books on the Park in the Inner Sunset in San Francisco, 1231 9th Avenue. And the talk starts at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, if you would like to talk about the power of art during these movements, if you're an artist or if you've just been affected by an image, if you want to talk about one of your favorite political artists, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or on Facebook. We are live on Facebook. Bonnie's here in studio. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio. I want to talk about some of the more positive images during the civil rights movement. The 1986 I Am a Man sign, which you could still hold today.
It's incredible. But it actually, its forebearer was, if you turn back, before that, before, from seven, that.
Oh, yeah.
Am I Not a Man and a Brother? Which was just imploring people to recognize their dignity, the African Americans' dignity, and it became this symbol, this medallion that people wore or held in their pockets or wore around their neck. I had never seen it before, and it's just such a powerful image. It was reproduced endlessly in the late 1700s and early 1800s. And so that's a question, am I not a man and a brother? But the I am a man came later.
And I'd never seen this before either. It's a photo of a black man kneeling down. He's got kind of a sash. He's nude, but he's wearing sort of a sash around his midsection, and he's in chains. 1787, designed by Josiah Wedgwood, a Quaker organization. The Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade enlisted Joseph Wedgwood to design the symbol as a cameo. Its image was adopted by abolitionists, and its words were revised by civil rights activists about 150 years later.
Turned it into "I am a man." Also, there was this horrible history of referring to African American men as boys.
You found a lot of images. You've got one of an African-American young man holding the sign, but then you also have a photo that was taken on the 44th day of a strike in 1968. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it was the sanitation strike. Two sanitation workers were killed, and they were striking to improve the conditions. They were killed in a truck. The picture of the entire group was outside the church where they collected their signs for the march.
And "I am not a man," it was a slogan. They changed the question to a statement in the form of this simple poster. The message: we are no longer asking you, we are telling you.
I am a man.
Wow. The sign achieved a singular, extraordinary power when it was hoisted up in multiples. So you've got this photo here of hundreds of black men holding the sign, "I am a man."
It's amazing.
What strikes you, Bonnie? And then there's other signs by women, "Honor King and Racism."
Well, 4 days after that picture, the picture of the group, Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. Mm. And so they had another march and had similar signs, more "Honor King and Racism" and promoting the strike. But it was actually a silent march.
What strikes you about these posters, these signs that just have block letters?
Amazing. I mean, when the message is strong enough, it's amazingly powerful. No distractions.
Mm. Today, we're speaking with Bonnie Siegler about her new book, Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. And she compiled hundreds of visual images from some of the most important social movements of our time. There are difficult photos to look at and also very inspiring photos to look at, which is what we need.
That as I was making it, I literally went back and forth between hope and rage. They were both, which is how I feel today. Mm-hmm. I feel more patriotic, literally, than I ever have in my life, fighting for our country and what we all believe in, and I'm furious.
You can join us at 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about political art, the power of art, if you're an artist, if you'd like to talk about some of your favorite visual artists, there are so many in the Bay Area, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We are also live on Facebook. Who are some of your favorite visual artists doing protest art today?
Today? Idel Rodriguez has done an unbelievable job on everybody is now familiar with his portraits of Trump. He's done a million magazine covers. In there, I have the Meltdown and Total Meltdown, which was sort of a call and response Time magazine cover. Mm. Those two.
Oh, right. The orange face with no eyes, no nose, just a wide open mouth.
Exactly. But those were, one was in August and one was in October,
wow,
which is incredible. And they were so strong that you recalled that first cover 3 months before. Really amazing.
And in the description, you write that these covers represent a real-time response to the perceived meltdown of candidate Trump. The first one appeared in August 2016 after he attacked a Gold Star family. The second one in October after the Access Hollywood tape surfaced. It was the first ever call and response pair of magazine covers. Too bad they were wrong. Instead of melting down, Trump was elected.
Yep.
What else strikes you about the images that we're getting now? A lot of media are also putting images of Trump and various artistic messages on their covers.
Well, this was actually after Charlottesville. After Charlottesville, stuff did change. I mean, I think people were reluctant before that to outright label him a white nationalist, racist, you know, all of that good stuff for some reason. I don't know why. It was clear from day one. But after Charlottesville, people came out and were pretty open about what was going on.
Mm.
And consistent.
Yeah, I mean, there's one by Bob Stake, Trump is the flame that the KKK uses to light their way. Brian Stauffer, Trump is the match that lights the fire.
And these were all in mainstream publications.
Where were these? Do you remember?
I don't. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. And then the Washingtonian had a cover story.
That's actually art.
Right.
On the cover.
Right. Because I thought to myself, there's no way that they put a swastika on the cover of the Washingtonian. But someone took the cover and...
and corrected it.
Hmm. And there's just... what about the signs that were seen at the marches? I mean, what the thing that I loved about the first march was they were all homemade. Because sometimes you go to these marches and Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, all these groups
right.
pass out the signs. But the overwhelming majority are now homemade.
My favorite thing, I was at the march in Washington, and what I'd never seen before was everybody came... I mean, there's so much to be upset about. And everybody took the thing that really upset them, whatever group they belonged to or whatever, you know, they were angriest about, and made it. So the pool together was so powerful because it was really all about upholding all men are created equal and treating people with decency. But everybody had their own take on it. I loved the signs at the march.
Mm. Bonnie Siegler is out with a new book, a beautiful book of resistance called Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. And she compiled images, photographs, posters, magazine covers, focusing on the most important social movements of our time. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to highlight two works that are around this San Francisco area. One is that series of simple but really vivid line drawings about all the men who've been killed by the police. You know, the Alex Nieto one was the first.
Yes.
And everybody in this area has seen these.
Mm.
They're just so telling. And another one is... something that's cropping up in my neighborhood, which is also the radio station's neighborhood, the Portola, called Resisters.
Mm.
So the two parts are separated, and there's kind of a graphic of I don't know what some kind of line stuff mm. with a cat, you know, a little cat at the top. And that's done by some local artist. I met her, but I don't remember her name. I will find out, and I hope that I can reach her today to get her to go to the Green Apple tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Judy. I'm so glad you brought up. It's Ori Original is the artist who has these block images of young men who've been killed. Alex Nieto, Mario Woods, Almacar Perez Lopez. We had him on the show, I think it was last year, but you're just reminding me we should have him back. His stuff is amazing. You can find it at justiceforourlives.com. And what about that? I mean, there's so many artists doing incredible work now. What I love about what Ori Original does is he does these block prints of these young men, and some of them are black and white and some of them are in color, and he puts them out around on buildings, on signposts, so people see them.
Yes, it's very powerful. Those are beautiful. One thing that I definitely noticed throughout the book is when people have one incredibly strong image and just a few words, it really draws your attention. And the most successful ones have done exactly that. But I also just wanted to point to this. This is the Berkeley Political Poster Workshop. They produced over 600 different posters. They formed after the Ohio National Guard shot and killed four students. Mm-hmm. And they decided to specifically, with a mission, to use art as a protest weapon. And they were all over Berkeley. But what's crazy to me now, so amazing work, 600 posters, they silkscreened them on whatever paper they could find, and they were seen all over Berkeley. Mm. But today, those can be on Instagram, on Facebook, on the internet, and be seen around the world in minutes. So this is really why I wanted to include these posters in the book, because they were so powerful and seen by one small community at the time.
Wow. 50,000 prints of 600 different protests.
Different posters.
What else struck you about the images coming out of the anti-war movement during Vietnam? You have a lot of images in this section.
There was so much to work with. It was really the first time, like, the left just completely came together for all the obvious reasons.
You've got posters, people holding signs, "Drop acid, not bombs," and then lots of posters, "F the draft," people holding their draft that's on fire. Another one that gets a lot of attention, it was created as a Mother's Day card, "War is not healthy for children and other living things."
Yeah, that was done by a woman named Lorraine Schneider. She was part of a group called Another Mother for Peace. It was just a grassroots group of moms who didn't want their sons to go to war. And it was a Mother's Day card originally. It has lived on. It was hanging in my house when I was growing up. But on the inside of this Mother's Day card that they sent with the "War is not healthy" image on the front, it said, "For my Mother's Day gift this year, I don't want candy or flowers. I want an end to killing. Mm-hmm. We who have given life must be dedicated to preserving it. Please talk peace."
I mean, almost every image you have here in the Vietnam section could be carried today.
Yeah.
"The next war will determine not what is right, but what is left." And then you have another one that's connected to civil rights. 1969, "You can't jail the revolution" was a Black Panther slogan, and here refers to the Chicago 8 anti-war activists who were charged with conspiracy to cross state lines with intent to incite a riot during the 68 convention, the Democratic Convention. The members included members of the SDS, the Black Panthers, the Yippies, and this illustration references the sprinters who gave the Black Power salute on the medal stand at the 1968 Olympics.
I love this poster.
Well, and this one is, so many people are bringing this poster out today to talk about what Colin Kaepernick is doing, what, you know, basketball players who are speaking out are doing.
You can't stop us, and there are way more of us.
Bonnie Sigler is out with a book of visual images, Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. And she will be in conversation with Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible, tonight at Green Apple Books on the Park, 1231 9th Avenue at 7:30. It's in the Inner Sunset in San Francisco. Let's go next to Reed in San Francisco. Hi, Reed. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was wondering if your expert there knows anything about Rockwell Kent, or whether she encountered any of his work in the course of her research.
I'm not familiar. What period did he do work in?
I would say probably around in the 20s. He illustrated a lot of books, but he was very political.
This is your call. I am so sorry about that. We are connected to Sala Burton High School in San Francisco, and they had a scheduled fire drill. Usually it doesn't come on in our studio. Sorry for piercing your ears, Bonnie.
I'm fine.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left with Bonnie Sigler, visual graphic designer, out with a book called Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. Bonnie, I wish we had a couple more hours to go over all of the other ones, because it's just full of amazing images. But after putting this book together, as a graphic designer and as someone who is very, very active now, how has this affected you and your activism, the art that you want to make?
What I really love is when people tell me they show it to their teenage kids. And it's sort of like this really fun, easy way to learn history. Not that I don't think history is fun, as it is, I do, but to introduce children, teenagers, to subjects, things that went on in the past that they might not have really known about, about just thinking about women not having the vote. And women had to fight for 72 years to get the vote. That's, you know, off of most kids' radar, I imagine. But I think it's important to understand it's a long fight sometimes. Mm. And just to see that happened in the past and understand why their moms are so angry today.
I think that's such a good point, because this would be a great book for high school students.
I agree. It's because it's Instagrammy, you know, in that way. Easy images to look at and understand, without having to read, you know, too much.
Well, so you have some amazing images in here. In 1920, there were efforts to oppose suffrage. They began in 1912. And this poster you've got in here says, "Men, you are making the world safe for democracy and safe for women, that your mothers, sisters, and wives may never have to suffer as the women of Belgium and France have suffered. Okay. All women, thank you."
I have no idea what they're referring to, I have to say, because Belgium and France didn't give women the vote for another 20 years. Does anybody out there know why the women of Belgium and France were suffering?
Well, this is the Virginia Association Opposed to Women's Suffrage. But then after that, after 72 years fighting for suffrage, women felt optimistic about their progress, and they have this great handout where they're literally rolling over the opposition.
It's great, isn't it?
And
they're wearing their sashes.
Final thoughts, Bonnie?
I think we all just have to get involved. Obama said in his farewell speech, we can't take democracy for granted. So I think every single person has to get involved in whatever way they can, for whatever cause they believe in. But we can't take it for granted anymore.
Bonnie Siegler is a graphic artist. Her new book is Signs of Resistance, A Visual History of Protest in America. Bonnie will be in conversation with Roman Mars tonight at Green Apple Books on the Park in the Inner Sunset in San Francisco at 7:30. And again, I'm sorry for the noise, but we are connected to a high school in San Francisco where they are currently having a fire drill. Bonnie, thank you for coming in. Thanks for this amazing book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's your call.